On this episode of Skeptico,
there's this famous quote about truth passing through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted as being self-evident. And I'm reading your critics, these scathing criticisms of your work, and I'm going, this is exactly what's happening here. I mean, folks go to the Wikipedia entry for Caesar's Messiah, and you'll read these guys saying, again, as Joe has mentioned, you know, Richard Carrier, atheist, biblical scholar, highly credentialed, you know, Robert Price, very well credentialed. Jay throws himself in that category. Take Bart Ehrman, all these people, and they're all saying the same thing. Atwell's full of crap. Oh, but he's right about the Bible being pro-Roman. And I just wanted to scream. I mean, this is, to me, this is what's relevant to today's lack of analysis, lack of insight. I mean, what the heck do you mean the Bible is pro-Roman? That is the whole story. If the Bible is pro-Roman, then Christianity, as we know it, is not what we think it is.
Once you've accepted the fact that it's pro-Roman, then you need to take step B and say, well, then the Romans probably had an influence in producing it. And now at that point, then you have these events which are oddly parallel between, you know, the Roman military campaign and Jesus's ministry. And frankly, at that point, how do you even deny that one is related to the other?
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and I'm still struggling a little bit with this introduction because this interview that I'm about to play already has a long introduction already, but I feel like I need an intro to the intro, so let me get to it. A couple episodes ago, I did an interview with Jay Dyer. Jay is a guy who hosts a website called Jay's Analysis. He does all this kind of analysis of film and culture, and Esoteric Hollywood was this book that he wrote. Very, very good book that lays out all this excellent evidence for these esoteric and occult symbols and themes in movies. So the thing I really wanted to bring to the forefront in that interview with Jay was, hey, aren't we all just secular atheists here? I mean, what's going on? Culted esoteric themes in movies? I mean, I think we all have a sense that that's there. But at the same time, as I looked into Jay's work, I found that even though his analysis of this occulted Hollywood thing was quite good, all his conclusions led back to his Orthodox Christian worldview. That is, this is all bad because it's all of Satan, and everything we need to know about it is right there in the Bible. Now, let me switch gears for a minute, because while you might not like Jay's answer, the one thing, the kind of skeptical thing that I would do is flip that around and look at the other side that I was just alluding to, the mainstream view, which is complete denial, right? It says, a cult? What a cult? It's just misguided people dressed up in weird costumes, flashing symbols at each other. Never mind the hundreds and hundreds of years of history of this. Never mind any insiders that have revealed all this stuff. Never mind any attempts that anyone ever makes to understanding these extended consciousness realms, because, hey, they can't exist. So keep that in mind. You know, you're usually being presented with just two choices here. Believe the Bible or believe it's all in your head because we're all biological robots in a meaningless universe. Now, I wanted to lay out that bit of background because, as you know, I think the secular humanist, atheist, why people believe weird things meme is disastrous and it leads nowhere. And not only that, but it's been proven wrong over and over again. But I also think the Bible tells us so meme doesn't hold up very well either. And that's what I really wanted to talk about in this Skeptico episode with my guest Joe Atwell of Caesar's Messiah. Now, one more thing before I play the interview. And this is one of those things that really makes this, for me, like a quintessential Skeptico episode. I mean, I've had to tell everyone I can beforehand. I tell my wife, you know, I always told you guys, you know, my wife like never listens to Skeptical. I like sat her down. I forced her. I go, oh, you got to listen to this. You got to understand what's happening here. Because this is, to me, what kind of Skeptico is all about. So if you remember my original interview with Jay, you'll recall that he was all guns blazing when it came to debating this stuff. He was like, oh, I'm sorry I hit you so hard on this stuff, but I really know this stuff and I know I'm right. And I'll debate Joe Atwell anytime, any place and all that. Here, I'll play you some clips from what he said.
Okay. Well, I mean, I wrote a paper about this, a grad level paper 10 years ago, dealing with Wars of the Jews and Matthew 24 and Luke 21. So I'm not trying to be arrogant, but I'm just saying, if you haven't read, you know, the patristic literature from the first three centuries, and you haven't looked into, you know, the fact that the church was persecuted for the first 300 years by the Roman Empire, I mean, this thesis is really kind of ridiculous. Well, I would be glad to debate any of these topics. If you want to have a debate or if anybody else wants to debate it, that's fine with me.
So while he's saying all this, in my head, I'm thinking, man, I've been through this over and over again with Atwell critics. I went through it with Richard Carrier. I went through it with the episode I did with Joel Watts. I've done it with so many people, posters on Skeptical Forum and, you know, people who write me emails and all this stuff. And it's always the same script. Ha, ha, ha. You believe that crazy Caesar's Messiah stuff? That's been completely discredited. And then time and time again, they just crumble. There's all this bluster, all this confidence, and then when they're really pressed, they back down. But nonetheless, I'm always a little surprised when it happens, as it did in this case. Because despite the fact that Jay Dyer and I left the last interview on very good terms, with all these plans to do this follow-up debate, Jay has not responded to my numerous requests for a follow-up interview. And after you hear this interview, which was recorded when I thought that Jay was going to come back on, I think you'll understand why he probably decided to decline the invitation. Here's my interview with Joe Atwell. So a couple weeks ago, I was interviewing Jay Dyer of the very excellent Jay's Analysis website, That Jay Dyer, and we were talking about film analysis and culture analysis and geopolitics, all of which Jay does a really good job of. But since I had dug into Jay's work beforehand, I knew there was something else that I wanted to talk to him about, because Jay is an Orthodox Christian and somewhat of a biblical scholar. I mean, that's part of his training, and that's part of what he brings to his website. And he's open about this in terms of how it informs his worldview. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way. I mean, Jay's not like a Bible thumper who's trying to inject, you know, scripture verses into every sentence. And Jay's also a really sharp guy who I have a lot of respect for in terms of his work and his analysis. He's on point on so many things. But this issue of religion, and in particular this Christian worldview and how it informs things, is something that I just can't really get away from. I think it's so central to a lot of things we're going through today. But I also think that it's an example of what Skeptico is so much about in terms of big picture questions, controversy, intelligent debate. So I had this rather lengthy exchange with Jay, got a little bit Bible geeky on it, but it was fun. And I decided at the end of it that this dialogue would be a great way to kind of bounce me into somewhat of a threaded debate with a guy who I really, really enjoy talking to, and I've referenced many times on this show, and that is Joe Atwell, author of Caesar's Messiah. So I asked Joe if he'd come back on and do this thing, and I've been in contact with Jay as well, and I think we're going to be able to make that happen. But Joe has been patiently listening to that long-winded introduction to kind of set the table, but he's with us right now. Joe, welcome back to Skeptico, and thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure, Alex. Thanks for having me on.
So, as I was alluding to, one of the things that really excites me is Okay, so you wrote this book a while ago, Caesar's Messiah, The Romans' Conspiracy to Invent Jesus is the title of it. You've written another book since then, Shakespeare's Secret Messiah. We should also mention that you blog regularly at postflaviana.org. And you also have started a podcast that I'm enjoying. I've just kind of tipped into it and I'm digging more and more. There's some great stuff there. But people, I think, sometimes get tired of me pounding on the Caesar's Messiah thing. But one of the things I wanted to start with is maybe pulling at some of the threads that are kind of on the outside, tangential to this directly Caesar Messiah's debate. Because even as we were just chatting about a minute ago, I think what it really gets to is, how do we analyze the data? How do we sift through it? How do we analyze it? Especially when there's this kind of shitstorm of controversy, which you have been through. And I think is awesome that you've, you know, withstood it. So do you have any thoughts in general about how these kind of highly charged controversial debates are especially relevant to our times right now?
Well, first, you just personally, they're fun to engage in. I like a lot of the debates I've done, and I would have to guess it to be around 100. And I've done quite a few with Christian scholars. And as far as how to think about sort of the whole Caesar's Messiah thesis, you know, it really isn't for me to tell people exactly how to approach it. But I would just note that I'm bringing sort of a different quality of evidence to my theory of how Christianity developed, which is basically I just produced the text. I mean, the whole Caesar's Messiah approach is just to lay the Gospels in their in the sequence of events that Jesus goes through the story with the events that are recorded by Josephus, the wars, the war between the Roman and Jews. And so it's just a different quality of evidence. You know, the fact is that you can just subtract me out of the whole equation, which a lot of people are doing now. Actually, there's a lot of people that really, they get the book and then they take it and they go off into study groups. You know, they just, well, we don't really need to contact Atwell. We can just sit here and do it ourselves. And I think that's really what I would recommend is, you can just take the text and simply go through them and see for yourself that there is a dependency.
See, but Joe, let me interject something, because I'm not sure I quite see it that way. I think you bring a very important element to this, and part of that is that you seem to have been able to put this into a context that few others have been able to really do. And, you know, now I'm so glad that we have the term deep state to throw around as a replacement to conspiracy theory, because right. conspiracy theory has been totally co-opted by the people who invented it, and it's done its job. But what we're really talking about, and what you're talking about in the book, in the context that you bring to this, is that maybe we need to look at this history askew. Maybe we need to look at it from the standpoint of what motivations people have. And with that, I guess where I was going, and I'd pull the lens back even a little bit further. What I think is relevant to the discussion we're having right now is that when I talk to people about Joe Atwell and Caesar's Messiah, the first thing I hear when I mention your name, the first thing is, oh, this guy's been discredited. Did you hear what Bart Ehrman said? A sophomore could rip his thesis apart. With that, what I'm going to do now is play for people the clip from my interview with Jay, where he just says, look, you know, this is just ridiculous stuff.
So you can look at Protestant scholars even that talk about how the canon came into formation, like F.F. Bruce, renowned New Testament scholar for decades. It's just completely contrary to like public scholarship about what happened in the first 4 or 5 centuries that brought the biblical canon together. And you can, again, you can read those two books just for example, that just completely blow all this out of the water. It's just, it's nonsensical.
One of the ways that Caesar Messiah, I think, is understood is as a complete refutation of everything about Christianity, and that it was completely contrived manipulation by the Romans. Now, I don't buy it to that extent, but I remember distinctly early on, one of the first times I talked to you, and I brought this up, and I thought your answer was so perfect in that I said, but Joe, I mean, do you really think that the whole thing, you know, every fiber of it was invented by the Romans? And you said, well, I don't know. I can only go by the evidence we have. And the evidence we have shows that a pro-Roman conspiracy is evident in the Bible. And from there, it's all speculation. And I thought now it shifts the debate from whether there was a Roman conspiracy to what extent there was a Roman conspiracy. And that I felt like you were open to debating, but you had now shifted the landscape, the table on which everything would be placed. Do you have any thoughts on that and whether or not the whole idea of the entire invention of everything about Christianity, it's whether it's an all or nothing thing for you?
It's impossible to tell to what degree there was a historical individual that the character was based upon, or to what extent there was a quasi-pacifistic version of Messianic Judaism that was basically used as a template. I would just go back to my original statement, which is it's impossible to tell. I don't really feel it's something that I need to actually attempt to prove, because my role is much smaller. It is simply to show that there is a dependency between the Gospels and Josephus that is just far, far greater than had ever been recognized before. The questions you're bringing up have to do with, you know, with religion, and also with ultimately with sort of the template that was used to construct the story. And Alex, honestly, I wouldn't have any better thought than anyone else on any of that.
Beautifully said. And again, this is like a skeptical moment for me that seems to slip past most people. And that's that, you know, there's this famous quote about truth passing through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted as being self-evident. And I'm reading your critics, these scathing criticisms of your work, and I'm going, this is exactly what's happening here. I mean, folks, go to the Wikipedia entry for Caesar's Messiah, and you'll read these guys saying, again, as Joe has mentioned, you know, Richard Carrier, atheist, biblical scholar, highly credentialed, you know, Robert Price, very well credentialed. Jay throws himself in that category. Take Bart Ehrman, all these people, and they're all saying the same thing. Atwell's full of crap. Oh, but he's right about the Bible being pro-Roman. And yeah. I just wanted to scream. I mean, this is, to me, this is what's relevant to today's lack of analysis, lack of insight. I mean, what the heck do you mean the Bible is pro-Roman? That is the whole story. Right. If the Bible is pro-Roman, then Christianity, as we know it, is not what we think it is. Right. Christianity is not about the Bible being pro-Roman, right? I mean, you've already deconstructed that partially, but I want you to particularly focus on how these guys can do this sleight of hand that I think is even deceiving themselves. And that one hand they're saying, oh yeah, that theory's totally crap. But yeah, I guess he's right. I guess the Bible is pro-Roman. How are they maintaining those two things in their head?
I'd have to be a psychologist. I think that once you've accepted the fact that it's pro-Roman, then you need to take step B and say, well, then the Romans probably had an influence in producing it. And now at that point, then you have these events which are oddly parallel between, the Roman military campaign and Jesus's ministry. And frankly, at that point, how do you even deny that one is related to the other? And so it's sort of interesting. Like the video of the documentary has been seen by over 2 million people now. And that's really, I think, you know, kind of how the information is spreading out into the population. Is it through the video, which has now basically been pirated and it's available on YouTube, so people can see it without paying any money, which is sad, but I'm happy to have the information go out. But the scholars, I think, you know, actually what really unfortunately is at back of most of the criticism is just that New Testament scholarship is a very, very finite resource pool.
Right. And it's what you're saying is it's professional job.
And so these guys are trying to make their living, and here comes someone who doesn't come from their academic background, and I'm getting all this publicity. And my book is selling them like, you know, 20 to one or something. And so they, there was resentment at that level.
But the other thing I think there was resentment about, that again, I'm going to keep pulling it back to our current situation, our current climate, is these guys had all the data at their fingertips, right? So if you read them, one of the things they say that's like kind of like a Greek tragedy or something, they go, we already knew that, though. We already knew that Josephus and the parallels with Mark, you know, we knew that. It's like, yeah, you knew it. How come you weren't able to make the connection? How come you weren't able to take the next step and see the implications of the fact that Josephus is showing up in the Gospels? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know, I just want to say is that, so now, you know, I pointed out that this character, Joseph of Arimathea, is an obvious, he's obviously dependent upon the character in Josephus himself, you know, because the event where Joseph Bar Matthias takes the guy down from the cross, there's a group of three, and this character survives. It's obviously the basis for the story in the Gospels. Well, now on the internet, there's just literally thousands of people that are like going, what the heck? This looks very much like it's this parallel. And there's all sorts of now original scholarship that's coming out. But it was actually something that was first presented in Caesar's Messiah. But it's so transparent. It's so obvious. So the question that's always asked to me about that is, well, how did everyone miss it? And how could you have seen it, right? How were you able to see it? And I always, this is the kind of the power of the sequence that they have presented for us, you know, that we can follow in both stories. I said, well, the reason I found it is because I knew where to look. I knew it had to be between these two other parallels in terms of the sequence. So I actually was able to then, you know, I wasn't going to go through, you know, millions of pages, try to find this thing. I actually could just look in a couple hundred words of text, and there it was.
Now, let's just clarify for folks. Again, this goes back to your idea of this side-by-side analysis of Josephus's writing on the War of the Jews and the Gospels, primarily the Gospel of Mark, right?
Yeah, if you break the stories into their temporal sequence, because some of the text is in other places and, you know, you have to do, there's a little bit of puzzle, but not too a whole lot. You can then just go straight down the list of the events in Jesus's ministry and then look and see if there's something over here in Josephus that is parallel. And you know, some of them are kind of cognitive and obviously I'm exposed for criticism. You know, if you take the most abstract of the parallels, but others are basically the same historical event. I mean, the destruction of the temple complex, the destruction of the Galilean towns, the encircling of Jerusalem, the abomination of desolation. I mean, the leaving of Galilee to go to Jerusalem. I mean, these are just historical events that are in Josephus's history. They are also in the ministry of Jesus. And when you put them side by side, you can see that they're occurring in the same sequence. So these are kind of these historical events, which are obvious parallels and obviously dependent, just form the basis, the structure for all of the other parallels. And so you can, once you plug everything in, it's really not a very difficult thing. I know it when people, you know, first hear it, that sounds like it's complicated, but actually once you start, you know, reading Caesar's Messiah, it's really not very hard. Because I get so much feedback from readers, I can tell you that really what they left for us, that what the Romans left for us in terms of making sure that we would give them the legacy that they wanted, the immortal legacy for having been so clever as to create the Roman Judaism. that we would get it, right? It's not meant basically once you kind of know it's there to be hidden from people. So it's...
Well, see, but that's a little bit speculative because we don't know exactly how that plays out. I'd take you back to your first point. We don't know. We don't know the extent to which Josephus thought it would play out this way or that way.
It doesn't, you know, it like extinguish the possibility for these historical basis for any of this. It just, that's why they would do something like this, is they're vain and they want legacy in the future.
With that, let me back up again, because I want to talk about Josephus in some very basic historical terms that anyone can get. I took a passage from our old friends, Masters of the Culture Shaping Wikipedia, and their write-up on Josephus. And, you know, for folks, for this inside baseball stuff, let me try and add a little bit of kind of reality check. Most people do not know who Josephus was, and that's to be expected, you know. And even the people who do know it, I've found, you know, if you bring up the name Josephus, a lot of times Christians who've delved into Christian apologetics know, and they go, oh, yeah. But the first thing they'll say is, oh, yeah, he was a Roman historian, which I think is really interesting because that's
right. Part
of how the message has been passed down. So let's talk about Josephus line by line, if you will, from what I pulled from Wikipedia. Fascinating stuff to me. This is like what's so cool. So the first little tidbit. So he's, you know, they're talking about the life of Josephus, and they pick up at this point. Josephus traveled to negotiate with Emperor Nero for the release of 12 Jewish priests. So I should back up a little bit further. Josephus is kind of a big dude, big heavy hitter dude. He's a rabbi. He's in the highest order of the Jewish culture or Jewish establishment in terms of both religiously, militarily, governmentally. He's an elite, if you will. And at some point he goes to Rome. And I think this is kind of significant, don't you? I think it's a story of a kid being dazzled by the bright lights of the big city. Do you get any sense of that?
Well, we know about Josephus from Josephus.
Right.
And no one else has ever written about him. I would say he's just as a component of history, is among the most important individuals that we have, because he really is the whole historical foundation for Christianity. I mean, no one else wrote about this era. I am convinced he's a fictional character. I don't think such an individual could possibly have existed. I think that I don't mention this in Caesar's Messiah because I have enough of a introduction of new information, and it's not necessary for the theory that he'd be, you know, fictional. But
when you say fictional, let's be clear. I mean, it's someone who's inflating his own biography, really.
Well, I think he is just tipped to stern. I don't think there's any part of him that's real. What I suspect they did was they wanted to create an author of the history that was completely authoritative, that couldn't be in any way questioned in terms of his ability to deliver the truth in terms of Judaism. Because this is what Josephus brings to history, is he brings this this very specific understanding of the Jewish prophecies and how the Jews are being cursed because of their rebellion against Rome. That's something that many people have seen, that he's actually describing the same curse that Jesus does, in terms of the end of the covenant between God and the Jews.
Okay, now hold on. We're getting a little bit ahead of the story, but yeah. I think I understand why you're going that way, because you're introducing a very controversial alternative theory, and that is that Josephus himself, that historical figure, is not a historical figure.
Yeah, it's
but
an
invention.
Bloom.
So yeah. What I want to do, since that's going to kind of require another brain
leap. Yeah, I know. It's too complicated. I know.
It's not necessarily too complicated, and it deserves to be, you know, kind of pursued. But what I want to do instead is is hold that, and we can kind of keep that in the back of our mind.
Just go through, because people should know the historical details about Josephus as well.
Well, we don't know if they are historical, as you're pointing out. Well, we don't know if they're historical.
They have been put into historical books purportedly. You know, so
yes.
As the Wars of the Jews reports through Josephus about himself, he was actually a member of all three of the Jewish sects. And this really makes him unusual. He was an Essene, a Sadducee, and a Pharisee.
Right. Completely
unique as far as anyone can tell. In fact, if you look at the scrolls, the idea of like leaving a particular sect didn't seem like a, you know, something that you could actually do physically because you'd probably get killed. But nevertheless, Josephus claims he had this background. He was also somehow an emissary to Rome. And, you know, mentioned the episode where he, you know, meets Nero's wife. They give him presents. He seems to be you know, familiar with the court manners in, you know, in Rome. Now, when the war breaks out, in spite of this relationship he has to Rome, he is made the general of the military forces in Galilee. Right. So here you have a priest, and not just a priest. Remember, he is from the family of Matthias, which would be the royal family of Hasmoneans. So he is he has a very powerful sort of lineage of details in his life and pedigree that makes him just, you know, extraordinarily Jewish. I mean, he is just the quintessential, you know, example par excellence of Judaism at this point.
Now let me just interject, because now I'm getting more, as you're saying this, I keep thinking about what you were saying before about him being invented character, but I want to leave that aside.
Yeah.
But I do want to highlight here, back to my earlier point now, folks, contrast this with what most Christians understand when you ask a Christian, who is Josephus? And they go, he's a Roman historian. Right. So now what you're saying is, no, he is the quintessential Jewish elite. Right.
Exactly.
That's who he is at this point.
He has theological and family and priestly backgrounds, which make him absolutely authoritative as a Jew. So that's why, in my opinion, why, you know, he was constructed in this form, because now when he delivers the blow, when he in the Wars of the Jews, when he says the covenant between God and Jew and the Jews is broken, and there is a new covenant between God and Roman, that now what you're getting is this statement is from some entity, some being that is so authoritative that he just can't possibly be criticized.
So let's build up. It just takes a minute. Let's build right up to that point, because so the war breaks out. He's appointed general, defend Galilee. And then what happens?
Well, he's captured. His forces are captured. And now is where the story really gets weird, because he's captured by Vespasian and Titus.
And hold on, because there's a great twist here. Before he's captured.
Oh, right. The tunnel business. Yeah. Where,
yeah.
Right.
Tell that.
Well, he
let's just be clear. This is his account of his war record, right? So he's pushed into a cave with 40 of his compatriots, and they're going
to. And they basically play a mathematical game to try to determine who would commit suicide first. And at the very end of it, Josephus is the last person there with someone else, and they go, you know what the heck, let's not commit suicide.
Right.
And so they are captured, and now Josephus has a trance. He goes into a religious trance, and he comes out of it, and they bring him to Vespasian, and he goes, you know what? First of all, you're going to be Caesar. You know, they say they're going to send him to Nero, and he goes, nah, Nero's dead. You're going to be the Caesar. Of course, at this point, Vespasian is claiming that, you know, he's not really interested in the role, which is a little suspicious. But nevertheless, that's what the story says, is that Vespasian is surprised. But then it turns out to be correct. And so now they go, well, you know, gee, this Josephus guy looks like a prophet. And Josephus then says, by the way, you know, the God's good favor, which had been given to the Jews, the covenant that's described in the Torah, that's gone. And in fact, the covenant is now with you.
The significance of this, Joe, fully pull out the significance of this. I mean, what he's saying is a complete rewrite of Jewish religion.
Oh, absolutely. And what Josephus is doing is he's saying that all of the prophecies that were basically looking to messiahs who would be in the lineage of David, that all of that theology, all that prophecy, that actually was all developed, in fact, to predict the Flavian Caesar reign. Now, what's amazing is that this is basically exactly what is going on inside the Gospels, where you have all of the prophecies then are being funneled into this character, Jesus Christ, who is pro-Roman. The thing that most confuses people about the character of Jesus Christ is that he has a relationship with this guy he calls the Son of Man who's going to come in the future, right? He says the Son of Man is going to come and you have all of this apocalyptic stuff happens. So what they're doing is they're funneling the theology using what's called typology. They're funneling it through Jesus and then into the wars of the Jews, right? So that now when all of the prophecies that Jesus makes about the future, what's going to happen, it's all going to end up with the Caesars basically being the recipients of all of the Jewish messianic prophecies. And then Josephus, at kind of the dramatic conclusion of Wars of the Jews, he actually then writes that, you know what? Amazing thing. The Jews rebelled because they were looking to a Messiah. But you know what? Actually, the Messiah is the Flavian Caesar. So now when you look at the character in the gospel, you know, that is Jesus is looking forward to, you would see that, well, you know, there it is. It's the Flavian Caesar. There is the Christ that Josephus was and Jesus were both predicting. Now, just to show how, I just want to give an example of, like, I would have to say it's like cognitive dissonance. I hate to use the expression. It's not a nice thing to do, but I'll just say that, okay, so the relationship between Jesus and the war is obviously artificial. This hasn't really been given to the population, but there's a very, very simple way people can look at this and understand it. And that's just the dates of the terminations of the events. I mean, Jesus's life, he becomes the Passover lamb of the new covenant, right? When he is set up as a Passover lamb and crucified, and that's on Passover 33, right? You can determine that date from details in the gospel. Now, in the original, the first covenant, you had the 40 years of wandering, right? From the Passover to the date when the Israelites were given the ownership of Israel. 40 years for the new covenant. Well, what happens 40 years to the day from Jesus's, the Passover lamb of the new covenant, his death? Well, that's the date of the conclusion of the Jewish war when Rome is given the ownership of the promised land. I mean, this is obviously the 40 years, the precise, you know, cycle of this wandering in the wilderness, thing in the Old Testament. Being recreated here with the new covenant. You can only do this in hindsight. And this is an example of, you know, Christians often will take the position that it was real miraculous stuff for Jesus to basically make these prophecies. And in order to have that position, they need to basically have the Gospels written before the war, right? Because if they're written after the war, then the non-supernatural explanation is obvious, right? So that's why they'll try to date the writing of this stuff to some of it anyway, to pre-70, so that they can at least hold on to this idea of it being miraculous. But the fact is, you know, parsimony simply demands that we accept the non-supernatural explanation if it's, you know, coherent. And in this case, it's just transparent. I mean, it's basically they constructed the religion as a, you know, as a way to both pacify basically the Messianic Jews in far as their rebellion against Rome, But also to set up the Roman Christianity, which would be something controlled by the Caesars.
Okay, and with that, let's reintroduce some clips from my interview with Jay, and I think that dovetails right into what you're saying. Let me play these last two clips for everybody.
So I want to make one more point, though. Again, this is very crucial to Atwell's thing. The preterist argument, which is the idea that most of what you're seeing in Matthew 24, the Olivet Discourse, and Luke 21 about the last days, and even the Book of the Apocalypse, which I referenced, Days of Vengeance by David Chilton, those books don't stand alone. A lot of what's in the Apocalypse is out of text from Isaiah and out of text from Ezekiel, and they're out of text from Daniel. So what I'm saying is that it's not like you can build this thesis just on these New Testament chapters and say that it coincides with Josephus, because no one will argue that Josephus was around in the days of Daniel.
Okay, so re-explain your point and why that doesn't hold.
Well, you know, he's saying that because there is a typology the author has introduced into the story of Jesus that is from the Old Testament, that this means that the story of Jesus basically should be seen as having been written before the war. And in other words, he's able to maintain the supernatural explanation.
What he's saying in simple terms is, hey, it's not just Josephus, right? Because before this, I hit him with the fact, I said, doesn't it, again, this goes back to what I think we're really talking about here is how to analyze and how people, even really smart people and people who are scholarly and spend all their time, now Jay doesn't, but some of these other biblical scholars, how they can miss the boat. And to me, the way they're missing the boat is that it all boils down to, like we were saying, pro-Roman. If it's pro-Roman, if Josephus is in the picture at all, then Daniel doesn't matter. And the old, none of it matters, because we're in this kind of mess of there's a soup of stuff going on. And we can argue about how it's put together and whether this person was inspired divinely or supernaturally or any of this. At least part of it, we have a very natural explanation for, a historical explanation for, a conspiratorial explanation for, and that is completely incompatible with what we're asked to swallow whole with Christianity.
Right. I mean, the idea that because the author interjects Daniel, we should then not recognize the pro-Roman total milieu that we're in with this literature is just not a strong interpretive framework. I mean, basically, Jay is just maintaining the principles of someone who believes in Christianity. This is faith. This is
it's self-referential, right? It's true because the Bible says it's true.
Yeah. It's actually a fascinating comment. I was thinking about it, when I was playing it, that Jay is really having to find a way to keep the supernatural intact in his mind. And I don't mean to be, I'm just trying to be honest about what I'm experiencing with a statement that is so oddball, because frankly, I could just sit here and create literature all day long that would blend a character from our current time and the Old Testament to create typology. In other words, it's just such a trivial literary technique. But to Jay,
People do it all the time with channeled material.
Exactly. Of course. I mean, just as an example, I mean, someone has, originally writes Superman, and then 100 years later, there's still people writing about it. They can use, literary techniques from, current time. They can blend them in, but they can always reach back to the original story and just slip them in as types, as things that you can use in the present day story. But none of it matters if the original story is fiction. You can't ever, no matter what you do, go back and try to basically make the original story something that it wasn't. And, you know, the story of Jesus is obviously just pro-Roman. So that's, you know, that is really the way that you want to be looking at this literature, is like, well, how would Rome have influenced this? And then when you think of that, you think of the fact that the Flavian Caesars claim to be the Jewish Messiah, the literature doesn't really have any mysteries, in my opinion. It's just very straightforward, very easy to understand.
Okay, clip three, and this is somewhat of the clincher in terms of what we were talking about just a minute ago. Here goes.
Even Josephus says that the destruction of Jerusalem seems in some way to kind of be a covenantal curse upon Israel. Now, he doesn't believe in Jesus. He doesn't think that it was for the rejection of the Messiah. What I'm saying is that if you read the book of Deuteronomy...
Well, he thinks Titus is the Messiah. I mean, that's what Josephus believes. I mean, that's his whole conversion, right? He's in the cave and he tells everybody, okay, we all have to commit suicide. And then he has incredible revelation, goes, hey, wait a minute. We were all wrong. Our whole Judaic tradition had it wrong. The Messiah is here. It's Caesar. Caesar is the Messiah. Let's go. And that's what he lives and writes for the rest of his life. So, I mean, that's Josephus.
Again, a real quick way to dispel this is that there are 300 years of persecution of Christianity throughout the Roman Empire.
So this is kind of stunning. That pause there is stunning. Jay doesn't know this.
Right, which is really actually amazing to me, because he is, you know, a very good research individual. But what Josephus wrote, which is, I mean, can only be seen as the climax of the entire story, says what more than all else incited the Jews was their oracle, which was found in the Torah, which stated that one from their country would become the ruler of the world, right? The Messianic prophecies. And the Jews thought that this meant someone from their race, and that they all went crazy because of this. But in fact, it was the reign and dynasty of Vespasian. And then Josephus, something like he said that, you know, no one can escape their fate, even though they can foresee it. In other words, you know, you're going to get crushed, even if you're, you know, you can see that the future is going to be of that nature. So that's the, you know, but my point is that Josephus said that that's what caused them to rebel. This is really what caused them to rebel, was an error in scriptural understanding. So you can't really understand the whole sort of point of Josephus's work if you don't have that as an understanding. You need to know this. Everyone really needs to think about this, and they need to think about this in light of you know, Jesus' prediction about the Son of Man who's going to come during the war, right?
Right.
You need to look at this statement and just honestly ask yourself, well, could this be? Could the Son of Man Jesus predicts be this individual? Well, folks, I hate to say it, but it's just self-evident. And then, if you don't mind, I would like to comment on the idea that there was a persecution of Christians for 300 years. I mean, sure. This is just simply inaccurate. This is basically a propaganda idea that later Christians brought into play. But the fact is that, you know, at the end of the first century, you have what's called the Christian Flavians, which were the imperial family, you know, members of the Christian religion. This is where you have the first catacombs of Flavia Domitilla, who's Titus's sister or his niece. And you have all of these people who are Christians that are buried with great honor and dignity inside of Rome. This is the end of the first century. And then you have Trajan, and Trajan actually, you know, they have a recording of what he said about it. And he said that that they are not to be sought out. There's an exchange between Trajan and Pliny the Younger. And he says, no, he says, you know, don't chase them. Don't seek out Christians. And you know, if they're guilty, punish them. But if not, just leave them alone. There is a confusion about the first, say, you know, 80 years of Christianity in terms of Rome's, you know, so-called persecution of Christians, because this was during the era of the rebellions of the Messianic movement. You had the first one in 66. There was an absolute bloodbath around 115. And then in 133, you had the final one with Bar Kokhba, which was just another just absolute genocidal bloodbath. I mean, these were the most destructive wars that Rome ever encountered. And so during that period, if you were a Messianic Christian, yeah, it's easy to imagine, you know, there would be a tradition about this. I explained some of this in Caesar's Messiah. I don't want to get, you know, inside baseball too far, but just, okay, so that's the first, you know, 150 years. Then you have Severus. I mean, you know, he gets actually, Eusebius records that he had a Christian barber and he wouldn't let people, you know, cause any trouble to him. There was an empire-wide persecution in 302. But you see, what's really important is that actually has some historical documentation. And what it was Diocletian, and in 302 he says, hey, we got to get rid of these Christians. And so what they did was is they kicked them out of high places in the government. And, for example, they destroyed the Christian church in Nicomedia, which was right across from the imperial palace, literally across the street, and it's gigantic. It's 150 yards long. So you see, there was no general persecution of the Christian as a systematic thing. It was just, you know, sporadic, and different emperors would go after them depending on whether or not they wanted to return Rome to its traditional religion and stuff. So if you, and then I don't want to get too far into it, but if you just look at what's called the six authentic, you know, the most authentic persecutions, they're all basically groups didn't like Christians, and then there would be some kind of battle, and then Christianity would maintain that there was martyrdom, and this reflected Rome's persecution of them. But actually, this had nothing to do with Rome in general. It was just these individual, you know, groups that would have these battles with Christians. You know, I could go on and on. This is a something that I'm not sure we, you know, would be too interesting for, you know, but I would just reference that there's a couple of really good books now. Candia Moth wrote a book called The Myths of Persecution. And, you know, she estimates that there was like maybe 10 to 12 years in the first 300 years where Christians were singled out. Christians basically would take prosecution, because if you look at the original martyrs, they would be prosecuted for individual crimes. And in Rome, you know, they didn't want to maintain a prison population, so they would just execute you for just about anything. And so these were not a general persecution, which you can see from, you know, the Flavian catacombs right through to the gigantic church in Nicomedia in 300, that Christianity was never, you know, other than between 302 and 305, really singled out for persecution by the emperor. And then, of course, after the 305 issue, Constantine stepped in and it becomes a state religion, which was really more reflective of the relationship between Rome and the religion. So anyway, the idea that there was some kind of 300 years of persecution is simply inaccurate, and the texts show that it never happened.
I'm really glad you went through all that. A lot of new information for me. But at the same time, it almost, you know, further demonstrates how easy it is to get knocked off of the thread line and into the weeds. Because, you know, back to the big picture and back to the analysis thing we're talking about. Here's what's going on, right? I hit Jay with the bomb here that he doesn't, he's escaped him. Is that... Yeah. Josephus is completely co-opted by the Romans, right? And he doesn't have it. This is central to the whole thing. And the diversion, the retreat tactic, and I'm not saying it's like conscious or diabolical or anything like that. It's what we all do. It's a cognitive dissonance thing that you talk about. It's like, well, wait a minute, my world is spinning. So
yeah, so he switched. He tried to like deflect. He said, well, I can't really go further with your point. it leads to a kind of chaos. So I'm just going to go to my fallback, which is the persecution angle.
And this is what's happening over and over again in the kind of debates that we're all seeming to be having today.
Maybe we should redo that because I don't want to like blow the point. No.
I think we're there. I think it all has to be in the soup, you know, because that's what happens when you have complex, controversial debates with intelligent people. Because like we're both saying, Jay is a sharp guy. Jay's not a dummy. And Jay can stay. We'll see what Jay says in response to this, right? Because he will have a response. So this is what makes it hard. It's not like we're beating up on the town idiot here. This is an intelligent debate with people who've thought about it deeply, are going to reference a lot of sources. That, you know, I'll go back. We'll pick up back on Wikipedia here. And I hate Wikipedia for a lot of reasons, but, you know, this is, again, back to the biography of Josephus, and I had to come to this kind of closing point on it, you know, because this biography goes on, and it's talking about Josephus, and he goes to Rome, and he marries, and that doesn't work out, and he remarries, and he has a couple of kids, and he gets a pension, and, you know, historians look at him in a way that, you know, why did he commit suicide and all this? Again, you know, if you take your alternative thing that he's completely invented, or if you just take the situation as it unfolds in the history that he tells, they're completely missing the point about who Josephus was. And they're talking about him in this other way that is completely.
It's fascinating, isn't it? Yeah, that's right. They don't look at these bizarre attributes of his personality as having any relation at all to their belief in this, the history we've been given. I mean, it goes to kind of the way that people address 911. You know, it's that just the socialization is so powerful. We don't see it going on. We don't understand it, but it's there. And it just shapes how we see the world. And the oligarchs know this. You see, they have basically broken the code in terms of how human mind operates. And so they can, you know, they create stories and, you know, realities that are to their benefit. And yet we can't see the fact that they're fake because we've been socialized. We just believe the version of history we're given. And so Bible scholars end up not looking at Josephus in the right way, in the way that, well, let's look at how he could be fitting into the whole pro-Roman perspective we see in the Gospels.
And like 9/11 or like your piece on Gloria Steinem, which we're probably not going to be able to get into in this show because we're running out of time, it's the trick of the culture shapers to know that eventually the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle will be turned over and people will have the pieces. So then the goal is, as you're just stating, is to keep them from being able to put them together in any kind of meaningful way. So yeah. Josephus is revealed, but let's keep everyone spinning their wheels from really putting it together in a meaningful way. We have a lot of the pieces of the 9/11 puzzle. Let's just keep the confusion level going so that no one really asks the right questions. You know, just to touch on the Gloria Steinem piece, of course, Gloria Steinem has been outed as being a CIA operative, and the narrative that was played out in the media was, gee, why? She says that was good for feminism. Was it good for feminism? Was it bad for feminism? And let's get into this big debate. And what I liked about you, your analysis, you stepped back and said, wait a minute. What the heck is the CIA doing trying to shape our culture by having this lifelong relationship with someone in feminism? And if that's, and it obviously doesn't end there, what game is at hand? To what extent are they trying to shape and manipulate culture? If they're doing it in this way, then in what other ways are we doing it? So in that way, Gloria Steinem becomes somewhat irrelevant other than pinning down the data points, the pieces of the jigsaw puzzle that say, yes, she did it, not just when she was starting the movement, but when she was with Ms. Magazine, and she's doing it today with her comments about Syria and her very slanted kind of, you know, look past these kind of atrocities on women and focus on these ones to advance a political agenda. I mean, maybe you want to comment in general about some of that stuff.
Well, I'm just, you know, would point out you're right. And it was very well said. I mean, once you understand that she is a CIA agent and that she lied about being an agent, she lied about doing intelligent work for the agency. She lied about the length of time she was involved with the Independent Research Service, which was a CIA cutout. Then you can see that the fact that everyone around her and promoting her, funding, you know, Ms. Magazine is involved with the CIA, then you can see that the CIA is mucking around inside our culture, that she was a CIA version of feminism. And so the question is what is the CIA's role in our world? Once you basically come to the position that, you know, the government is involved in the production of culture, now, you know, you can't really trust basically anything in the media. And what we need to do is to set up our own media, our own method of gaining and vetting facts and information, of looking at terrorist events, looking at the things that they use to socialize us, to shape us, and to do independent analysis, which, you know, is why, for one reason, people should support you so much, because you really are kind of the cutting edge as far as the considering of ideas and presenting them to the public. So,
well, that's nice of you to say, but before we go too far down that path, what I'd like to do is bring it back to Caesar's Messiah, because I think the parallels are inescapable and just so profound, because in the same way, it's the pro-Roman thing, Joe, right? It's back to saying, okay, but if we establish that there is this pro-Roman aspect to the Bible, then, as you said an hour ago, then it becomes a question of what the heck are the Romans doing trying to influence the process? So the same thing. What the heck is the CIA doing? What is the extent to which they're trying to – we know now that they're trying to shape culture. To what extent are they doing it? Why are they doing it? When are they doing it? What should we believe and not believe? And that's what I think you're doing in Caesar's Messiah. And the reason I think that escapes so many is they're just – unwilling or unable to open themselves up to this broader deep state understanding of how the world works. They want to stay in really kind of this juvenile kind of make-believe world that, you know, people don't really do all sorts of mean, nasty things to advance their own agenda.
Right. That's exactly right. That's one of the hard lessons that come from Caesar's Messiah. And I think it is part of why some scholars sort of reject it out of hand, is because it leads directly to a different kind of responsibility of the citizen. I mean, if Christianity was a tool of the oligarchs, it meant that 2,000 years of basically mind control was effective. And so now when you see, you know, things like A Course in Miracles, which is creating this neo-Christianity coming from a CIA project called MKUltra, you know, you have to be more skeptical, and you have to just basically take that position intellectually of there is, you know, influence by sophisticated technical people that is creating basically a matrix of illusion that is the world I know, essentially. So I have to, you know, develop new analytic skills to be able to get to the truth. And it's really critical that people do this, because, you know, the oligarchs, they aren't playing for, you know, just trying to, you know, basically reduce the middle class. I mean, these things, these concerns are of genocide, of dramatic population reduction. We really need to know more about the group that controls our government.
Perhaps, and I don't want to cut you off there, but I want to make one point.
Sure.
Because I think it's an area where I think we are able to kind of synergize and synthesize some of our thinking, is that you have a business background. And I do too. And you combine that with more of a scholarly, and you know, you read Greek and Latin and all that stuff, and I don't. But my background's more IT. But I tell you what, anyone who's been in business sees this in a not necessarily quite so conspiratorial thing. It's just like, hey, man, that's how freaking shit gets done. Are you kidding me? No. Influencing, corruption, buy-off, manipulation. That's how stuff gets done. Grow up. So did the Romans know how to make stuff happen 2,000 years ago? Are they placing their bets here that Christianity, this little project might work out? Are they and at the same time, are they placing their bets over here that this might work out? Yeah, that's how they're doing it. Are they also mixing in maybe some kind of belief in the supernatural? Because that's the other thing. We haven't even talked about it. But when the atheists approach this whole topic of Caesar's Messiah and the creation of Christianity, they take a very cynical view of the supernatural that is completely at odds from everything we can tell about history. So the Romans, it seemed, were able to balance these two. They did believe in the supernatural, but they also believed that, hey, this is how you get things done. This is how you dominate a foreign nation. You go in and you co-opt their religion, you take them over, you bait and switch, you do all these dirty things. And like a lot of religious people we see today, they are still able to, in some twisted way, reconcile that with some very strange supernatural beliefs we have as well. So maybe as a final point, I'd ask, do you have any thoughts on maybe the oversimplification that I see is done by a lot of atheists in really understanding the supernatural beliefs that the Romans did have?
Well, you know, the atheist community has a kind of arrogance, which I think makes it vulnerable. They aren't always basically sort of intuitive as to how theology blends in with power. You know, you look at, for example, Aleister Crowley and the connections he has into all of the different political systems, you know, in Britain and the United States.
And intelligence systems, right?
Yeah, and of course he was a, you know, MI6 agent, you know, as well as being a kind of a Luciferian. And I think that what I see is that atheists can't, you know, in general grasp that there might actually be a whole theological structure that's basically within the secret society that you know, comes to us through history, is that they just wouldn't share with the common person anything that would be useful, basically.
Well, two things. One, let's substitute theology for a reality to these extended consciousness realms where some of this stuff is going on. So I would say atheists cannot contemplate that as part of their worldview. Whether they would completely accept it or reject it, it's not even on the table. And when you have that kind of blind spot, you're crippled. And you're crippled from what number two is, what I think is at play, is atheists are part of the psyop, right? Because if there is this theological kind of occulted underpinning to a certain group of these controllers, shapers, then what better means to manipulate, to subterfuge, is to kind of introduce this group over here that's completely spouting this, you know, useful idiot atheistic nonsense that you can just kind of point to over there and use as part of your plan as well. So even that doesn't have to be totally true. It can just be a possibility that has a lot of usefulness or explains a lot.
Of course. I mean, you know, the to maintain power, you have to be basically changing your form as culture deforms and changes and shifts. And so I think that the middle class Christian ethnic neighborhood was not something the oligarch wanted to see. And so you started having basically cultural Marxism, all kinds of different programs came about, which ended up with its, you know, close to being disintegrated now in the United States. But, you know, these elements, and atheism was one of them, they weren't being given as a benefit or as something that was going to take us to a better place. It was done to atomize us, to separate, to break apart what was holding us together. I know this is an odd thing for someone who wrote Caesar's Messiah to say, but even Christianity was attacked as in a kind of weaponized fashion. You know, you can have something that is really, you know, people don't understand how the social construction and the different aspects of it are needed for political power. You know, an ethnic neighborhood can resist something like pornography, for example. A friend of mine was telling me that he grew up in an Irish neighborhood, and he said, you know, some guy came in and tried to sell dirty pictures. He said the dads just got together and beat him up, you know. So that couldn't happen in the deracinated, you know, middle class. I mean, now it's, you know, you just don't have that kind of ability to repulse things which are, you know, against the cultural glue. And so we're being atomized. Now, at the end of it, you end up as individuals, and the state basically is in complete control over you. The component of power is dissolved, that being, you know, this extended family. And so, you know, what was in back of the atheism that was given to us, you know, in the 50s, you know, what had it been kind of weaponized, like feminism was weaponized, like integration was weaponized, like all these other seemingly really valuable cultural components had been weaponized? Sure.
See, but hold on. There's an important point there that I want to persist a little bit further, because I've spoken with you kind of off the record on this, and I want to get it on the record because I think a lot of people don't understand your position. I was going to say your open-mindedness, but that sets you up. I want you to say whatever you think. You know, I have to credit my buddy Gordon White at Rune Soup for kind of helping me clarify and see this more clearly, and that is that whatever we want to call this deep state shadow government, one thing is for sure. They are totally committed to pursuing these extended consciousness realms as a reality. So whether that be in a Luciferian way, as some people see, satanic way, or just in a how can we weaponize whatever the spirits are and you get them on our side, or however you want to see that, they have been in that game for a long time. So that's what MK Ultra is about. That's in all its different forms. That's what MK Often is about. That's what all these other projects are about. But the real trick is, while at the same time that's not only in play but a given for these folks, they've at the same time perpetuated and promoted through academia this complete rejection of this extended consciousness and what may or may not exist there and how it may be influencing our world. So what is reflected back through our culture, through academia, through intellectuals, through mainstream media is, oh, you think any of that stuff is real? Oh my God, you're so ridiculous. So we might be doing our Crowleyan kind of stuff over here in secret, but what we want reflected back in the culture is that that's complete nonsense.
Yeah. Well, I think I can't add anything to that. I mean, they obviously, if you look at the MKUltra experiments, they are absolutely fixated upon kind of a spiritual dimension, trying to get control over it, telepathy, all, you know. So the reality we have is to the extent they can, just a completely fake one. And so I would just say that, people just need to keep an open mind as to, you know, what is a correct spiritual path. They should be skeptical about basically what has been, you know, brought to us through the media in terms of, you know, what is real and what is not. Just look to ourselves, you know, look to what we can find inside ourselves with our reason, with our spirit, and develop our own spiritual context. We shouldn't be looking to, Miley Cyrus or the Kardashians or, right, you know, even the media gurus like Aldous Huxley to try to, you know, promote a theology that we can relate to. Stuff. So in my opinion, that's just all weaponized. Those are, you know, either they're useful idiots or actual lifetime actors, an expression I use for, you know, someone who has been, who basically creates a personality that is useful for the secret society to control the population with, someone like Gordon Wasson, you know, with his going down to Mexico supposedly to find the magic mushrooms. I mean, that kind of a character is being developed, you know, the personality is being developed as a weapon, something to get that we would trust and then, you know, take seriously. And so we have all of the media atheists today, you know, don't believe any of them. I mean, it's just these questions are not ones we should try to be answering in the context of a world that is fake. We have to first recognize that most of what makes up our intellectual structure is basically, you know, been deliberately given to us and is in fact incorrect. It's an illusion. So how do we get right? How do we get straight and think clearly? Well, I mean, first step is just recognize our situation and try to have an open mind as we move forward. Try to use logic, reasons, evidence. And of course, try to the extent we can, learn more and more about the secret society, learn more about the connections. The WikiLeaks that came out were very interesting because they talked about spirit cooking, which is just the Crowleyan ritual.
I'm going to have you back on yeah. to talk about that and yeah. to talk about other stuff. Because, Joe, you never disappoint me. You always over-deliver. It's just so cool having you on. Again, our guest has been Joseph Atwell, most famously the author of Caesar's Messiah. But I do encourage you to check out his blog and all the interesting work that he's continuing to do at postflaviana.org. I'll, of course, have a link to that in the show notes. And Joe, all the best to you. And I won't say, hey, you know.
Thank you so much, Ox. Interesting discussion. Yeah, we're just getting started here. There's so many different directions to go and so many things to cover. But it was really fun talking to you. Thank you.
Thanks again to Joe Atwell for joining me today on Skeptico. I always like to tee up questions from these interviews, and I'll do one here. What are the implications of a pro-Roman Bible? Joe and I were obviously quite enthusiastic about what that means, but, you know, maybe you see it differently, and maybe you'd like to share that with other people. Of course, the place to do it is through the Skeptico website, Skeptico Forum, which you can get from there. Or you can just send me an email or connect with me on Facebook or whatever other means you have of doing that. As I mentioned at the beginning, this is a quintessential Skeptico for me, so I really enjoyed putting it together and sharing it with you is always a pleasure. I do appreciate you listening, coming along for this ride, this journey, and joining me. I have a number of shows coming up, good ones I think, but I guess we'll see. Until next time, take care. And bye for now.